the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless, and those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind, and a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, sparked by replacing the spark in the hope the swamps of the approximate are not quite, the not yet, the not at all. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours.
All right. Well, thanks, guys, for tuning back in. I'm here again with John. I know we had a couple of audio issues last time, so hopefully this one's a little better for you guys. But we're excited to talk a little bit more about markets, about recessions, see if we can learn some lessons from the past to give us a bit of an idea of what's coming in the future. And John's had a lot of experience going through a lot of these, especially being in the financial sector during the time. So I wanted to open it up first, talking a little bit about an interesting article we were just talking about before we started recording, which was something about the Pope essentially saying that CDS markets are unethical. He says derivatives markets are a ticking time bomb. And this is very out of character for a Pope to be talking about finance, which is really strange. Q said that he was going to have a weird month or a bad month in May, and he already has with some of the stuff coming out about Cardinals. But it's interesting to see the Pope specifically targeting derivatives markets. And we were sort of trying to figure out why that was, but it's also interesting just to understand these markets at all. So the fact that the Pope understands credit default swaps is interesting to me. And so I was having John go over those a little bit at first. So if you could maybe describe just sort of how credit default swaps ended up leading us towards 2008 and the recession thereafter.
Yeah, so basically credit default swaps were originally created to provide insurance against a bond defaulting. So the buyer of a credit default swap is basically buying insurance. They pay a premium just like you would in insurance, and they pay it usually monthly. And if the bond doesn't default, then the buyer just keeps paying the premium and nothing happens. But if the bond does default, then basically the party that sold the credit default swap has to pay the buyer the face value of the bond. So it serves a purpose of providing insurance, and that's a good thing.
They're a relatively new invention, though, aren't they? Are people kind of sort of constantly coming up with these new tools and mechanisms?
Yeah, they were. I mean, they can be traced back. The roots of credit default swaps can kind of be traced back to roughly the mid-90s. There was a group at J.P. Morgan that kind of created the first instrument that was the predecessor to the credit default swap, the type of insurance that I just described. But they were kind of slow getting off the ground and didn't really become big until the probably mid-2000s when they started being used for a lot of other things, you know, besides just insurance. And so obviously the seller of the credit default swap must have a reason to want to sell this insurance, and that's probably because they don't believe that the bond is going to default, or that the probability of the bond defaulting, compared to the amount of premium that they're going to get, is way worth that risk. And so, you know, both parties were entering into a credit default swap for a specific reason, and it really wasn't a big deal until the housing crisis, the housing prices started to get into a bubble in the mid-2000s. And there was some credit default swaps started becoming more of a speculative instrument. And there was a lot of activity on both sides buying and selling those. And there was sometimes there were bonds being created just to have credit default swaps on them, and there were you know, eventually their credit default swaps were, I don't want to get too far ahead of us, but yeah, they were being used as basically synthetic bonds, because the seller of a credit default swap has basically the same exposure as someone who buys a bond.
So what were the sort of government catalysts that sparked some of the problems that started to happen? So I know there are certain laws passed that you mentioned before we started talking that sort of forced the market in a certain direction. I think there was, you said they were passed under, was it Bill Clinton? I think it was Bush actually.
Under both. There were, starting in the mid 90s, there was a push by the federal government to make homeownership more affordable. I don't know the name of the specific act, but it was a
something like the Affordable Housing or Equal Lending Act.
There was a series of different actions that the government took to make it, you know, easier, which is, it's, you know, that's, homeownership is a good thing, and it probably started out with the right intentions, but between the mid 1990s and mid 2000s, it really got out of control. Government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were also involved in making it easier for homeowners to get mortgages, and specifically homeowners that may not ordinarily qualify for mortgages.
So they essentially forced lenders to take what would normally be a very risky proposition, but they sort of incentivized them to do so. Is that right?
Well, a lot of these riskier loans were basically kind of backstopped by the implicit guarantee of the U.S. government through Fannie and Freddie, basically backstopping these loans, even though they're technically called government-sponsored entities, so they're not technically, but it's implied that,
yeah,
it, loans that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac issue would be basically backed by the U.S. government. So that led to a lot of loans being made that probably shouldn't have been. So it eventually got out of control, and what originally started as a pretty good idea to make home ownership more affordable ended up, you know, ultimately being one of the contributing factors to the financial crisis.
Yeah, significant unexpected consequences to that one. So, I mean, we were talking a little bit about, I guess, yield curves and bonds and how those can sometimes be indicators for the broader economy. And so you said, you know, there are certain points in the past where that curve had fallen almost flat. Is that right?
Yeah, so the yield curve is the difference in the yield of different maturity bonds, anything from really 2-year notes out to 30-year bonds. But what generally financial market traders, they look at the difference between the 2-year and the 10-year note. And
is that the shortest and longest period?
No, it's kind of the two most active maturities that are traded. You have everything from 3-month T-bills all the way out to 30-year bonds. And now they have something called an ultra bond. But
ultra
it's
bond.
Really, it's really the 2 and the 10-year spread that the market looks at. And typically there's around a couple of percentage points difference between that. We were just looking at this chart here, going back to 2013, in December 2013, the difference between the yield on the 2-year note and the 10-year note was about 2.6%. The 10-year note was 2.6% higher
yield. So what does that mean exactly?
Well, it means that's basically, at that point, it's an upward sloping yield curve. The 2 year is higher than the 1 year, and the 5 year is higher than the 2 year, and the 10 year is higher than the 5 year. It slopes up, which is what you would normally see. That's the majority of the time. The longer term maturities yield more than the shorter maturities. And so what we were just talking about is, you know, an inverted yield curve where the shorter maturities, like the 2 year note, has a higher yield than the 10 year note. And one of the interesting things about inverted yield curve is that it's a very accurate predictor of an economic recession. In fact, going back to 1955, inverted yield curves have predicted all nine recessions since 1955. In fact, the Great Recession of 2000 basically started in 2008. That was preceded by an inverted yield curve that it was inverted in 2007, and then in about a year after that, the recession started, the Great Recession. So it's we're looking at it now, like I said, back in 2013 at 2.66, the 10-year higher over the 2-year. And as of now, the 10-year is only about 50 basis points. 50 basis points is just a half of a percent.
So essentially, you assume that if you're locking your money up for a longer period of time, you're going to get a better return. And then it's sort of a red flag if all of a sudden you have a shorter bond term and it seems to be paying off more so than some of the higher rates or moving towards that interest rate?
Well, what's happening is that more investors are buying the longer term maturities, which is causing their yields to go down, because as the prices go up, the yields go down. So there's more demand for the longer term maturities, because the idea is that if a recession is coming, Federal Reserve will lower short-term rates in a recession. And when short-term rates go down, basically that means if you're holding a short-term note and it matures, you have to turn around and reinvest it at a lower rate. So traders are looking at a recession coming up, and they don't want to buy short-term notes because they expect there to be lower rates in the next few years. So they're buying the longer maturities, which causes the price of those to go up and the yield to go down. And then basically the curve between the shorter term and longer term maturities flattens and eventually goes inverted. And it's a very reliable predictor of economic recession. And it's not inverted yet, but it is kind of interesting, this chart that we were looking at, yeah, of how it's over the last, you know, roughly 4 years, 4.5 years, it's trended down from about 2.6% difference to now only half of a percent.
So what you're saying essentially is investors want more so to lock their money into a rate for a longer period of time, because they're assuming that somewhere within that time frame something is going to happen. So that's,
yeah, so the 10-year note is, I mean, they're buying more of the 10-year note than the 2-year note, because they're assuming that whatever economic recession is coming will have resolved itself in 10 years. And when it comes time to reinvest that money, you know, rates will at least be the same or possibly higher. They don't want to buy a 2-year note because they believe a recession is coming 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. 2-year rate is going to be lower because the Fed will lower short-term rates in a recession. In 2 years, they don't want to reinvest at a lower rate. It's surprisingly accurate, because the market for U.S. Treasuries, and when we're talking about the yield curve, we're talking specifically about U.S. Treasuries. That's, yeah, really what the traders are looking at when they look at yield curve and economic potential of economic recession. So the potential for there to be a recession is the fact that there's so much activity in this treasury market, and there's so much information that's reflected in that trading. there's a lot of people out there that study the economic conditions and they're pretty savvy that the trading reflects pretty accurately what will likely happen. So
well, they have the most skin in the game, so they have to get it right.
They do. So yeah, the yield curve is, yeah, like I said, it's a pretty inverted yield curve. Yeah. So it's not inverted yet, but it's almost flat. So it's something that traders should be aware of if they have a lot of exposure to equities.
It looks like some of the past drops were more, there was a higher derivative. So there's more of a, it was a quicker upward trend and a quicker downward trend. It seems like looking at the chart we have, and I can post this link for you guys, but it seems like we almost recovered there and then it started going right back down. So what do you think happened between those two peaks that let it again in a downward direction instead of back up? Or they're just certain, I guess it seems like they never really go above two. So is that sort of where it tops out, or, you know, is there room for more upward mobility?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the long term average, is somewhere around probably 1.75% to 2%. And we could probably find a chart that would show us what that average is. But you're right. It the yield curve did kind of peak at about 2.8% in February of 2010, and then it dropped all the way down to about 1.3% in August of 2012, but then it went right back up to 2.66
so
in December 2013. So it was headed down, and it was a pretty steep flattening that occurred. But it's hard to say what specifically caused it to come back up. But what we're seeing now is a pretty extended decline from December of 2013 to now. That we're not sure where it's going to go, but it's something that traders should probably keep an eye on.
So what kind of government policy are you keeping an eye on, or what sort of things affect these curves in a major way? So I think it's somewhat different from equities markets, where it's more reliant on government. Is that right? So more the Treasury and more the Fed?
Well, I mean, the things affecting interest rates would be, economic growth and inflation. And when interest rates go up for the right reason, it's good for equity markets. For example, interest rates going up because of economic growth, with inflation being relatively constrained, that's good, and that will lead to healthy equity markets. But when interest rates are going up because of high inflation or rapidly increasing inflation, that could, indicate slowing economic growth, and that could be, something that could indicate this potential recession that might be coming from an inverted yield curve. So kind of want to keep an eye on the inflation rate and on GDP growth. And we were just looking at the inflation over the last few months has gone from every month the government issues the, basically it's the annualized inflation rate. And in January it was, I believe it was 2.0, went to 2.1, 2.2, and believe in April is 2.5. You could look at a trend and see that it looks like the inflation rate is definitely picking up. But you would also want to compare that to the GDP growth to see if the growth.
I know GDP growth has been at 3%. I think if he hits targets again, in, I believe it was April, so I'm not sure if they hit it, but it was going to be an average of 3% for each month he had been in office. Trump had been in office, so that his target, I think, was 3% GDP growth, and I think they've hit it so far. In that case, would it mean that it's, so what would be the difference in GDP growth and interest rates that you would be looking for?
I would want to see that the growth rate of the GDP is kind of at least keeping pace or outpacing the growth of inflation. If inflation is going up faster than the GDP growth rate, that would, you know, was probably what leads to a flattening of the yield curve. So you want to see, you know, inflation going up is okay as long as the GDP growth rate is going up at least as fast or faster. So keep an eye on both of those, and also on the yield curve. If it continues, if the growth rate of inflation, if inflation is going up faster than GDP, and then the yield curve continues to flatten, I would see that as a warning sign for equities.
So how much do you think buyers of bonds, so like investors, so I know Chinese, I'm not sure, I think it was China, I'm not sure if it was China or Chinese investors announced, major Chinese investors, that they're no longer going to be buying U.S. bonds, so certain treasury bonds. So does that have, I guess, a broader impact on some of these rates as far as just how many people are willing to buy the bonds? So are there certain things that you can do to attract foreign investment that are good? Or, because I know during, you know, during times of war in the U.S., we've printed a lot of bonds. That's how sort of greenbacks got started. So is that something to be looking out for, is foreign investment versus domestic investment in bonds? Is that something?
Yeah, it's something you should watch, because the Chinese are the largest investors in U.S. treasuries. I don't know the exact number or the percentage, but it's a very large percent of our treasuries. And if they wanted to dump all of those, it could have a significant impact on our interest rates. And I think the headline that you might have been referring to about them not buying anymore was, I think it was kind of part of the posturing that was taking place around this potential trade war, yeah, and these the tariffs. And I think it was more of just
bargaining chip of sorts.
It was like, you know, hey, we can we can dump all of your bonds, and that would be bad. So
yeah, we've got some cards to play too.
Hey, I don't think that they will, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on, because if they do start selling, you know, I don't know that there's that many additional buyers that could replace them to the amount of volume that they hold. So it is kind of leverage that they have over us, that, you know, if we get into some kind of trade war with them, they could dump our bonds, but I don't think it's going to happen.
And so in that respect, is sort of running up the deficit and the global or the national debt, is that something that, I guess, rings alarm bells in other countries for other investors? Do you think they're paying attention to indicators like that? Or where do you think they're paying attention as far as, you know, do you think it's just the rates that they really care about? Or are they looking at more of the broad economy before they make those decisions?
So other investors in U.S. treasuries, I mean, how much outstanding debt does the U.S. have? That's something that they consider, but as long as the U.S. economy is continuing to grow at the rate that it is, the likelihood of the U.S. defaulting on any of those bonds is very low. It's they're the basically the highest rated, safest bonds that you can buy, and I think if our economy was not doing well, and we were continuing to run up debt, that would be a warning sign. But I think investors outside of our country would continue to buy bonds as long as it was apparent that we would be able to pay them back, because our economy was growing.
So it was pretty smart then for Trump to start with tax reform and some projects like that before moving on to other, I guess, other parts of his policy that are going to run up the deficit, you know, even more. People talked about that omnibus spending bill that was, you know, a massive amount of money. A lot of fiscal conservatives were very unhappy with that. But essentially what you're saying is really he would only have the impetus to do that so long as he made sure the economy was growing at enough of a rate prior to keep spending at the levels we are. Is that right?
Yeah, I think probably the best thing that came out of the tax reform was the corporate tax rate being lowered, because that has really boosted a lot of corporate profits. In fact, I read somewhere that the percent of increase in earnings, like for example, the first quarter earnings of 2018 compared to first quarter of 2017, that percentage increase has actually not been reflected in the amount of increase in the S&P 500 yet. Now, I mean, in other words, right. It means that the stock market basically.
So if you're trading on multiples of earnings, you would expect with a 20% increase in earnings, the multiple would be reflected in of that?
Is
that?
If corporate earnings have increased, 10 or 15% year over year, you would expect equity prices to reflect that. But I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but I had read that the percentage increase in earnings is actually higher than the percentage increase in equities over similar periods. So you would expect that to eventually get factored into the market, and I mean, it makes it look like there's more room for equities to run if there's not a recession. So it's a very delicate balance between GDP growth and inflation, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, because I know a lot of people were criticizing, you know, the multiples that a lot of especially tech stocks have been trading at, saying that it's sort of unprecedented, or at least hadn't really happened since more of the dot-com bubble. I mean, do you see any of the dot-com bubble reflected in what's happening with tech stocks now?
Yeah, possibly there would be more likelihood of a bubble in tech than there might be in say, industrial companies. But I think that's something that's probably pretty inherent to the tech sector.
Yeah, as it, there are always high expectations.
Boom and bust and, yeah. Cycles. The multiples on corporate earnings for industrial companies is not a high above the long-term average. I don't believe it's not a cause for alarm yet, but there's always, it seems that, you know, some tech companies, it is Apple, I believe, is a pretty low multiple from what I believe.
Yeah.
It's around 15 or 16 times forward earnings, I think, which is actually seems like a bargain.
Yeah.
When compared to some other tech companies that maybe hundreds of times.
They've been hoarding cash forever, but I think they're finally starting to pay back their investors. And that's something interesting too. It seems like companies really aren't paying out dividends the way they used to. Do you think some of these markets are being affected by the fact that there are so many more options for investing? So the internet has brought about the ability to invest in, you know, a property for Airbnb, or, you know, there are a lot of other ways people can invest. Do you think that's affecting markets at all? I guess that's sort of a broad question, but I mean, it seems like, do you think this model for markets is going to exist for a long time, or do you think people are going to start investing differently? The investing landscape will change, and
there's all these different asset classes evolving. I think that's a good thing to have for investors, to have choices of many different asset classes. It's not just stocks and bonds like it was many years ago. And so, you know, a good example of that obviously is cryptocurrencies, which is, you know, there's still a debate over what is that considered a an asset class? Is it actually a, you know, are they currencies? They're not.
Are they securities?
They're not. Yeah, they're not regulated yet by because they're not considered securities. But yeah, that may come. But it is, cryptocurrencies are definitely a, I guess it could be considered an asset class that investors can use to either speculate in or for whatever other type of whatever their goals are. I think it's a good thing to have a lot of different choices. So
yeah. So when people ask someone to manage their money, so I guess say you're not someone who's ever worked with a hedge fund or given your money to a hedge fund, when you give them your money, do you sort of specify, I guess, do you choose a firm based on primarily returns? Do you think people choose based on the sort of assets that they're investing in? I'm sort of wondering, I guess, what the major differences between hedge funds are and how they decide on what to invest in. Because they seem to, would you say that hedge funds drive a majority of some of these markets, that their decisions are pretty key in the outcomes?
They do have a big effect on certain markets that, for example, mutual funds cannot invest in. A good example is cryptocurrencies, because while there are a handful of mutual funds that have been able to figure out how to get some crypto exposure, it's not really that widely done in mutual funds, just because of all the regulation around them. Mm-hmm. Hedge funds are able to much more easily get exposure to cryptocurrencies in many different ways, especially with futures contracts now on cryptocurrencies, there's Bitcoin futures specifically. But I think in markets where hedge funds have a lot easier access than mutual funds, then they probably do have a significant effect on those asset prices.
Yeah.
Some of the markets that are much deeper, like, for example, we were talking about treasuries. Obviously, hedge funds trade treasuries. Mutual funds trade treasuries. Central banks do. Everybody does. It's a huge, very deep market. So hedge funds specifically as a type of investment vehicle really don't have any effect on treasury markets.
Yeah.
But if you get into a more esoteric asset class like cryptocurrencies,
yeah.
I think they
move
do
markets with a small amount of that portfolio.
They can, yeah. They can, and there's certain other markets, certain derivative markets. Although mutual funds can pretty easily trade derivatives, they're certainly easier to do in hedge funds, and there's some hedge funds that's focused specifically on derivatives, and they may potentially have some influence in some corners of those markets.
I see. So if I'm a hedge fund, do I have like a target for what I'm trying to achieve this quarter or this year? And what are some of the, I guess written into some of the contracts? Are there certain times where they have to pull money out of the markets and have sort of a clean book? I mean, is it at the end of the year where you have to pull out for taxes? Are there certain things like that that affect markets in a big way that people should look out for if they are trading?
Well, hedge funds really go on an annual cycle. It's really January 1st through December 31st is their annual performance, and that determines how everybody gets paid, because hedge funds usually charge a performance fee of, it used to be 20%. It used to be they would charge a 2% management fee and a 20% performance fee, the so-called 2 and 20.
Yeah.
Which, I believe it's come down quite a bit now.
Really?
I've been out of the hedge fund space for about 10 years, but when I was doing it, it was 2 and 20 was pretty standard. It may be more of a 10% performance fee and a 1% management fee. So what that means is from January 1st to December 31st, if the hedge fund has a return of 15%, basically the general partner of the hedge fund, which is really the company that's managing it, they would get 10% of that 15%, which is 1.5%. And then the investors who are the limited partners keep the rest of it. But if the hedge fund has a negative return, if it's down for the year, if it's down 5%, then the following year it doesn't get to start even accruing a performance fee until it's made that 5% back, which is called the high water mark. So
that makes sense.
Basically, then the hedge funds that you want to watch out for, the ones that have a kind of a high water mark that's kind of hard to overcome, because usually what will happen is if there's too high of a high water mark, say I gave 5% an example, yeah, which is not that hard to overcome. You could make 20% the next year and that 5% would be gone, and then you would have a 15% return. That's not that much to overcome, but if hedge fund loses, you know, 20% in 1 year, and then you have to make up that 20% the following year before you can start accruing any sort of performance fee. What happens with those hedge funds is you may start to lose a lot of key personnel. You know, a lot of the best traders or analysts, portfolio managers, who a good portion of their compensation comes out of that performance fee. So if they're working at a firm that they know needs to make 20% before it even starts accruing a fee, they're going to start jumping ship. That's usually what happens. And so eventually that fund loses all its key personnel in it and has to be shut down, and they, you know, basically liquidate all their holdings. So kind of the thing to watch out for is hedge funds that have had a pretty serious negative performance year. And if you see even the beginning of key personnel leaving, pretty good indication that fund may shut down. Now the general partner, or basically the manager, can just shut that fund down and launch another one, but they will have to liquidate all their holdings to shut it down. So that's, you know, all these positions that are going to be dumped into the market.
So what would be considered a good year? Like what percentage, you know, what return would be considered a really good year for a fund, in your opinion?
It depends what type of investment strategy they have and what their target is. There's some funds that are, you know, basically, you know, market neutral, where basically they say that they'll have a return that is not correlated at all to the equity markets. So a good return for those types of funds are, you know, even if equities are up 10%, you want the fund to be up something different, either more or less. Yeah. Because you're basically getting into that hedge fund and not to diversify away from equities.
Right. Correlating to risk at the end of the day.
Right? Yeah, you want to have the hedge fund to provide a type of return that it says it's going to. So if it says it's market neutral and equities are up 10%, you don't want to see the hedge fund up 10%. Even though 10% is not hard to argue with, you'd want to see it up maybe more or even less than that.
Uh-huh.
But then, you know, if equities are down 5%, you don't want to see the hedge fund down 5%. You want to see it at some different amount. And then there's different strategies that are more risky, and they may target a 15% return. It's not just the return, it's the volatility. They may say there's a 15% return with a volatility of I don't know, 10%, could be plus or minus 15%. Or they might be targeting an 8% return with volatility of 2%, 8% plus or minus 2. So it, as long as it's within the range of what they're saying the strategy should produce, I think the hedge fund investors are probably satisfied with that. But you don't want to get into a strategy that's marketed as a low risk, low volatility. I guess it would be alarming if you bought into a hedge fund that said it's, targeting 8% return with plus or minus 2% volatility, and then that fund ended up hitting 20% return, which would be great. But as an investor, you want to know, what did they do to get this 20%? Yeah. Like, what kind of risk are they taking on? Because that's not really what I signed up for.
Lose 20 next quarter. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's more, how are they performing versus what they said the strategy is expected to do, because you don't want to be caught off guard.
So I guess we've talked a little bit about, bonds, treasuries, equities, but I mean, really, I guess your bread and butter is options and futures. So what would you say about, I guess, getting into options, sort of the math involved? How long did it take you to really get familiar with the options process and figure out how to make money doing it?
Well, I would say it's definitely something that it takes more time to understand than just buying stocks. But it also gives you a lot more flexibility. You can make money when stocks are going up, or when they're going down, or when they're not expected to go anywhere. So, there's any number of books that can be read on the subject, but really the best way to do it probably is to read a book about options, and then to, you can open an options account with your equities broker, E-Trade.
Yeah, even Robinhood has it now. Yeah.
And they'll let you, most of them, I think, will let you paper trade. Essentially, you can enter option trades and see what the result would have been. But, it's really all an option is just, it's paying a premium to have the right to either, buy or sell a security within a certain amount of time. And so that it means if you think the prices of a security is going to go up, you want to buy a call option that will give you the right to buy that security at a certain price. If the price of the security is 30 and you think it's going to go up to 40, you can buy a call option that's out of the money with a strike price of 35. And so if the stock goes above 35, or even if it doesn't even have to go above 35, if the price of the stock goes up, the value of the option should go up if too much time hasn't elapsed. But it takes a while, and it's good to follow the prices and to see how the prices of the option move in relation to the price of the underlying stock. You'll see the option, basically the option price has two components, the time value and the intrinsic value. And any option that has a certain amount of time left until expiration, it has some value, because even if it's far out of the money, there's always some chance that there could be some news and it could pop 10 or 15%. So there's always the time value there until the very last day. And the intrinsic value is really like how close it is to being in the money, or when it's actually in the money, then there is intrinsic value. If the strike price is 35 and it's trading in the market at 36, you basically have a dollar of intrinsic value. So the best way to just get familiar with it is to follow some option prices and the prices of the underlying stock. And you'll see that the way that the option price moves as it gets closer to being in the money or in the money, eventually the option price moves pretty much one to one with the stock when it's in the money. Mm-hmm. The stock goes up 1%, the option should go up 1% when it's in the money. If it's far away from the strike price, the stock may go up 1%, but the option might barely move. And once you follow the price movements for a while, you'll get familiar with it. And there's various ways to tell, to calculate if an option price or the premium that you're going to pay for that option is a fair amount to pay, because really the key to making the money in options is to, not necessarily to buy the option and exercise it at expiration, but to buy it and then see the price of the option go up and then turn around and sell it. Yeah. So
assume that at some point within that time frame, it's going to tick up as a result of some movement, right?
Yeah.
So how do you choose like what time frame you typically buy the options? Do you have certain, certain time frames that you try to stick between? You try to do a week, a month, 3 months, Where do you think is sort of the sweet spot with?
Well, if you're trading options on equities, I kind of look for some type of news event that will be coming up. For example, an earnings report. Where there will be some type of movement, either the price will go up or it will go down. Usually, when there's an earnings report, something happens to the price. So, and you can, you can structure your option trades to where you buy a call that would make money if it goes up, and you buy a put that would make money if it goes down. And there's ways you can do it where you can, buy options and then you can sell some options that are further out of the money, and you can almost put on the whole position with very little cost. That's one way to do it around an event where you know there's going to be some type of price movement. Another way to do it is if you don't think the price is going to move for a long time, you can sell options. Basically, if you sell an option and it never goes into the money, you basically keep the premium that you receive for selling it. So selling options is another strategy that you do if you think the price is basically just going to be pretty flat for quite a while. So there's a lot of different strategies, and you should read about what they are, and then you should follow the prices before you actually start trading, because there's a lot of option prices don't move as smoothly as maybe equities do. They jump all over the place. And it's not, if you've been trading just exclusively equities and you jump right into options, the price movements of options would be a little alarming until you follow them for a while and see, how option prices move with regards to the underlying stock price.
Yeah, it seems like patience really seems to pay off with options, especially, I guess, here's one more question as far as if you are predicting, a big swing during an earnings announcement. So say I have a good feeling that NVIDIA is going to have a somewhat big earnings quarter and I bought an option, 3 months ahead of time, am I going to get a much better deal than I would get, a month ahead of time, or, regardless of which way people sort of think it's going to go, I guess. Do you think buying early gets you an implied discount just because so many people have their money in other places that they're not willing to stick it somewhere for, so many months ahead of time?
Well, if you buy a few months before the earnings release, you're going to pay more for the time value. Let's say the earnings is in, let's say the third week of April. If you buy in February, if you buy an option that expires, roughly the day of the earnings release, you're paying for 2 months of time value. Whereas if you buy, let's say, a week before, the earnings release, you're paying a lot less in time value. But you also have to look at what kind of news is going to take place in those 2 months. In February, the speculation as to how their earnings are going to be, it may just be speculation. There's not that good of information. And so the option premium might not be that high. There's more time value, but there's maybe less news out there about what the earnings are going to be like. And if you wait until a week before, you're only paying for a week's worth of time value, but maybe almost everything is known about what the earnings are, and it's already factored in to the price, and then the price of the option has gone up. So there's really no, there's no good rule as to when to buy it, but there are ways to determine if the premiums are, a good deal.
Yeah.
But it's really beyond the scope of our discussion. There's a lot of good books out there about it.
Do you have any you should suggest?
No, not offhand. It's just, you have to, basically look online and find something that kind of fits here. I mean, if you were looking for a beginner's option, a trading book, there's plenty of those that just basically get into puts and calls and just buying, outright buying options. And then you can get some more of the advanced strategies, buying and selling, or doing all sorts of different spread strategies like straddles and strangles and butterflies and condors and pretty interesting stuff that's really beyond the scope of like a beginning options book. But it's kind of what you're interested in, find a book that covers that and then just follow the action in the market.
You can just learn from there. I mean, I feel like the best way to learn is just by doing it, throwing a little money in and seeing where it goes.
You can buy options for, like I said, you can probably paper trade at most brokers. You can also buy options for pretty cheap. Most equities have a wide range. Most equities that have options traded on them. Not all equities have options. It has to be a company that actually have options on their stocks, but most of them have a pretty wide range of strike prices and expiration dates. And the farther out of a strike price you go and the closer you are to expiration, it's pretty inexpensive. You just have to remember that an options price is basically quoted in a, it's an option on 100 shares.
Yeah.
So if the option price is 50 cents, for example, you're basically to be paying $50 because it's 50 cents times 100 shares.
Yeah.
So
I think maybe that's one reason some people don't get into it quite as quickly, because it does seem like it takes more money to be able to de-risk it in such a way where you can make money, I guess. So the less money you have, the more risk you have to take on, I guess, in some ways, just because you can't, get into those really sweet spot calls.
Yeah. It's kind of daunting. There's been a lot of empirical studies done that most option buyers lose money, where the option sellers are the ones that make money.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of related to the fact that most beginning option traders are just buying,
maybe
buying a call on some stock they think is going to go up, and they're not really sure how to know if that premium is a fair price to pay for that call or not. And so there's a lot of research out there that says the option sellers, make more than option buyers do. So it's something that actually looks, pretty easy. You think the stock is going up, so just, buy this option for not a lot of money. But you got to remember that the price of that premium has been very meticulously calculated by the sellers.
Yeah.
And they have tons of statistical data that shows that you know, the probability of it going to a certain price by a certain date, you know, expected value of that, and they've already priced it into what it is. And so, you know, beginning option buyers, be aware, it may, you know, may not be as good of a deal as it looks. The sellers are the ones that, you know, the professionals that.
Yeah. And it's also
a lot of the hedge funds come in, like we were talking about.
Yeah.
They do that, you know,
it's fair to say
tons
that
and tons of research.
All the people also that would have some sort of inside information would probably be the people also buying options. Is that fair to say? So if you were, you know,
a lot of times when there's, you know, unfortunately you'll hear about it because the SEC basically they monitor, actually they look for spikes in option buying, like you know, buying of a big spike and buying a calls of a particular company, you know, like right before an announcement comes out that it's getting bought by another company and the price jumps up. That's such a red flag. The SEC now is really all over that kind of stuff. That in the last, I don't know, less than 10 years, they've invested a ton of money into big data, data mining. And if there's a spike in options buying and then a few days later the stock price jumps up, guaranteed the SEC will be all over it.
Yeah,
they have ways to, they have signals that will pop and it will alert them to this. So
don't trade on insider info with a big account.
No, the SEC actually, surprisingly now is pretty sophisticated with that, and they will, that kind of stuff, it's an immediate red flag.
Yeah. What's the minimum account balance you'd need to red flag? Do you think they're just looking for people who are, you've got like $1 billion they're playing with, or?
I don't know. I don't know what their threshold is, but I think, you know, any sort of, you know, if the average daily volume in call options on XYZ security is 1,000 options, and then on one particular day there was, say, 100,000 options, which is actually, you know, $10 million, because each option is 100 shares. So I would assume they probably are comparing the average volume to, you know, something that's an outlier, that's, you know, 50 or 100 or a few 100% more than the average volume in comparison to a price move of the security that's, you know, X amount over above its 200-day moving average or something. The SEC now actually has algorithms that you know, sweep for this kind of stuff. So you know, if you have some sort of way to back it up, you know, the SEC is going to come and ask, why did you decide to buy these options? Yeah. And it's to say, just, you know, I had a hunch, you know, probably not.
With my gut.
You know, they might do a little more digging if that's what your response is. And you know, hedge funds will, that's why they meticulously keep records of their trading
research,
you know, to back up their trades, and you know, in the case something like that happens.
Yeah, well, gotta keep an eye out for that. But with that, I mean, thanks so much for coming out. I think we've gone over sort of all the basics of finance and some of these interesting things that I wanted to get to that fall within your area of expertise. So I think we're going to stop it there. Thanks, guys, for listening. And we'll be back with some exciting new guests, a couple ICOs we have coming up this week that'll be interesting to listen to. So thanks for stopping by, and we'll see you soon.